Really frequently, the DeKalb County Jail, you know, many parts don't have running water, is what we're hearing from inside. Toilets are broken. There are freezing temperatures. And, you know, despite all of that, there have been vigils that organizers have been hosting outside of the jail as a way to communicate with folks inside. Shortly after their arrests, there was a large vigil that was planned, and things were projected on the jail, and folks were able to yell across the walls of the jail. A father of someone who had been arrested was able to speak directly to his child. And so there have also been really beautiful moments of solidarity and folks on the outside making sure that, you know, we're supporting folks inside.
Micah Herskin, I want to thank you for being with us, local community organizer in Atlanta, Georgia. I want to thank you so much for being with us. That does it for our show. On Monday, Democracy Now's Juan Gonzalez is moderating an online panel on Chicago's 2023 mayoral race, reclaiming Harold Washington's multiracial coalition. Details at democracynow.org. And a very happy birthday to Nermeen Sheikh. Also, Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Dennis Moynihan, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, March 25th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for our 2023 Bluegrass Marathon, live at Multnomah Grain 71. Uncle Chippy and Josh will kick off the marathon at 9 with a journey back to 1971, along with live recordings from local and regional acts. At noon, we'll head down to the Grange for live performances from several of Portland's finest bluegrass bands. Performers include Josh Cole Band, Sawtooth, Sunny South, and more. The event is also open to the public, so bluegrass fans are invited to join us down at the Grange. More information can be found at kboo.fm/bluegrass23.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the KBOO Evening News.
Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers weigh a bill to protect and expand reproductive and gender-affirming health care.
A new study finds Portland housing costs are prohibitive for people of color.
And experts advise preventative measures as an invasive beetle takes up residence in Oregon ash trees.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 24th, 2023. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. A bill in the Oregon legislature would expand access to reproductive and gender-affirming health care. House Bill 2002 would add protections for medical providers who offer these services. It would close service gaps and also expand insurance coverage for gender-affirming care. It's sponsored by 34 Democratic lawmakers, and it comes at a time when states across the nation are restricting abortion access and attacking health care and rights for LGBTQ people. These bills are grouped together for a reason. Seth Johnstone is the Transgender Justice Program Manager for Basic Rights Oregon. Johnstone told the Portland Mercury, quote, "Folks may think of this as multiple bills, but it's really one package bill because of the connection to privacy, bodily autonomy, and protections for all of our communities." If passed, the bill would strengthen protections for healthcare providers who offer abortion services. As long as health care providers are following Oregon state law, they would be protected from criminal prosecution for serving someone who traveled out of state for the procedure. The bill would also expand the definition of medically necessary gender-affirming care to include procedures that are currently considered cosmetic. This means that private insurance would cover those procedures. Research has shown that those procedures, such as hair removal, for example, can mean a nearly 40% reduction in severe psychological distress. The bill is expected to be debated on the House floor in the coming weeks.
Iconic Portland drag queen Darcelle 15 has passed away at the age of 92 from natural causes. Behind the drag persona, Walter Cole opened the Darcelle 15 showplace in 1967 with his partner. At that time, acceptance of queer identity was very different. Oral sex was still illegal in Oregon, and the state had just ended a policy that allowed forced sterilization of, quote, sexual perverts and moral degenerates, end quote. Darcelle has helped to turn a historically conservative Portland into a more accepting reputation the city has today. Darcelle is remembered for her towering wigs and raunchy humor. In 2016, she was named the oldest working drag queen in the Guinness Book of World Records. Details about the public memorial service are still to come, but shows at the Darcelle 15 showplace will still go on.
The Michigan State Legislature has passed a measure extending the state's current civil rights law to include the LGBTQ community. Advocates say it's the result of a long, hard-fought battle. Mark Richardson has more.
Advocates for Michigan's LGBTQ community are calling lawmakers' move to expand the state's civil rights law to include them a victory that's been a long time coming. The measure, Senate Bill 4, turns a series of court rulings into codified law, giving protections from bias based on sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. Tracy Hall with Outfront Kalamazoo, a community resource center, says because the state's Democrat-controlled legislature put the law on the books, LGBTQ rights can't easily be undone.
We had a court ruling, we had local ordinances, but now we actually have field protections in our state statute that do protect us when it comes to hiring and firing, public accommodations and housing. And these are big things.
Michigan joins 22 other states and Washington, D.C. to extend basic civil rights to the LGBTQ community. It was approved 64-45 in the House and immediately signed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Most, but not all, Republicans oppose the legislation, calling it a threat to religious freedom. Hall says previous attempts to pass LGBTQ rights legislation have stalled in Republican-controlled legislatures. She says the rising conservative tide that is pushing anti-transgender measures in other states makes the new Michigan law even more important.
It's a huge deal, especially in a time where you see anti-LGBTQ laws all over the country. So for Michigan to stand out like that means the world to me.
According to Equality Michigan, there are more than 30 groups across the state that advocate for the rights of LGBTQ citizens. Hall says her group, Outfront Kalamazoo, serves as both a gathering place and a community resource.
We are an LGBTQIA community / resource center, and we provide programs, services, support groups. We put on events. I try to, and I think our team tries to make this that safe space.
For Michigan News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
Lawmakers in Congress grilled the CEO of TikTok on national security concerns yesterday, and the House Pro-Choice Caucus wants to repeal the Helms Act to allow U.S. foreign aid to support abortion care. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2013 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We do not trust TikTok will ever embrace American values. Values for freedom, human rights, and innovation.
Republican Representative Kathy Rogers of Washington says the popular video sharing app TikTok should be banned in the U.S. TikTok CEO Shou Chu appeared before Congress Thursday defending his company against bipartisan concerns that the app is a threat to national security.
The bottom line is this: American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel.
Lawmakers are concerned that TikTok's owner, Beijing-based ByteDance, is providing Americans' user data to the Chinese government. Several lawmakers grilled Chu over concerns about teenagers' social media use and mental health. President Joe Biden marked the 13th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act at the White House on Thursday, calling it one of the most consequential pieces of health care legislation since the creation of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965.
And while the Affordable Care Act has been called a lot of things, Obamacare is the most fitting description. Obamacare.
Biden said Republicans voted some 50 times to repeal or weaken the law in its first 5 years and are backing plans to do it again. Members of the House Pro-Choice Caucus have introduced legislation aimed at repealing the Helms Act, which prohibits U.S. foreign aid from supporting abortion services and counseling. Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts says the policy is rooted in racism and imperialism.
Abortion care is health care and a global human right.
Repealing the Helms Act would lead to 17,000 fewer maternal deaths each year, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Attempts to ban or restrict books more than doubled last year, with more than 1,200 challenges documented by the American Library Association. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds says groups such as Moms for Liberty are empowering parents to defend their rights.
They came after our kids, but they sure didn't plan for the moms.
Bills aiming to restrict books have been proposed or passed in several states. Librarians have reported threats of violence or legal action. The California Senate has approved a first-of-its-kind price-gouging bill that would penalize oil companies. Supporters say it would increase transparency of gas pricing and move the state closer to using clean, renewable energy. The Arizona Supreme Court has revived a claim by former Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake challenging signature verification procedures on early ballots in Maricopa County. The court sent the claim back to a trial court to reconsider. While most election deniers around the country conceded after losing their races in last year's midterm elections, Lake has not. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Many people of color cannot afford to buy homes in Portland. That's the major finding from a new report by the city's Housing Bureau. Specifically, in 2022, Portlanders identifying as Black, Native American, and Latino who are making the average income for their demographic group would have been unable to afford the cost of a house anywhere within the city limits. The city considers property to be unaffordable if residents have to spend more than 30% of their monthly income on housing. The average Black household in Portland brings in about $3,000 in monthly income, while Latino households earn $4,500 and Native American households make almost $5,000. By comparison, white Portlander households earned $6,400 on average every month. The report says white residents can afford a home in about one-third of Portland's neighborhoods, most of them adjacent to the city's eastern border. The average Asian household in Portland earns $5,900 monthly, which could allow purchasing a home in one-fifth of the city. The average Pacific Islander household earning around $5,700 monthly could get a house in one-eighth of the city's neighborhoods. Similar trends were seen for people of color wanting to rent in Portland. In 2022, the average monthly rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Portland was $1,904. That means apartments across the entire city were considered unaffordable for the average Black household. Average Latino and Native American households could not afford to rent in two-thirds of the city. Average white, Asian, and Pacific Islander residents could afford to rent in about three-quarters of the city.
This situation comes about as a result of significant surge in housing costs in recent years, paired with inequitable income increases. For example, home prices increased 17% between 2016 and 2021, while Portland's median household income grew by 22% between 2015 and 2020. Incomes increased significantly for white households, while households of color saw minimal increases. The city has attempted to make more affordable housing available in recent years. Portland has created more than 4,300 units of so-called affordable homes since the city declared a housing state of emergency in 2015. Current city commissioner and former housing commissioner Dan Ryan says, quote, "It's totally sobering and depressing and not surprising," end quote. Portland is poised to receive financial support from the state to increase affordable housing. A $200 million housing package passed by Oregon Senate earlier this week. It includes $20 million to create modular housing, which is cheaper, and $3 million to help developers who wish to build affordable homes. According to city data, the median sale price for a home in Portland was $525,000 in 2021.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather forecast going to continue to drizzle and be chilly with an overnight low of 35. Tomorrow, we'll also have a good chance of rain and a daytime high of 48. Today in history, in 2018, students across the United States staged the March for Our Lives, demanding gun control in response to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting in Florida. The quote of the day is from American fashion designer Bob Mackie, who was born on this date in 1939. He said, quote, "Glamour has to come from you, and it has to come from confidence. The Pope is glamorous. There are people who are automatically glamorous. Marilyn Monroe was glamorous in a towel. She just couldn't help herself."
Spring is here, and while the cherry blossoms start to bloom, arborists are urging Oregonians to look ahead to the summertime and prepare their trees for a new type of pest. KBOO's Althea Billings has more on the story.
As the Pacific Northwest moves into spring, there's an unfortunate arrival heading over the Rocky Mountains and to the trees, the emerald ash borer. It's a green, wood-boring beetle that is responsible for the destruction of tens of millions of ash trees in North America. In June 2022, the beetle was found in Forest Grove, Oregon. That was the furthest west in the continental United States that it's been seen. Michael Spalding is the district manager in Portland at the Davy Tree Expert Company. He explains.
The emerald ash borer gets its name because it's a bright green metallic color. It's an invasive beetle that's killed hundreds of millions of trees all over the U.S., Midwest, East Coast, Southeast, all the way up to Denver. And now it's just across the Rockies and it's here. It decimates these trees typically from the top down, but typically on the warmer side, so you'll probably find signs of the emerald ash borer on the south-facing side of the tree in the canopy. And you'll see thinning and decline fairly rapidly. And these pests move much faster than a bronze birch borer that we've had here for quite a while. They move very fast, and the way that they take apart the tree from the inside, they make them very brittle, very dangerous, and hard to remove once it's about a 30% canopy dieback. And they're very, very fast and invasive.
Dr. Barry Lyons is a research scientist at the Great Lakes Forestry Center. He explained to National Resources Canada how the emerald ash borer kills ash trees.
The eggs laid on the trunk of the tree under a bark chip or in a bark crevice. The tiny larva, when it emerges from that egg, chews its way down through the bark to the surface of the wood. So it occurs in that interface between the wood and the bark, and the larva starts to form a gallery there. Well, that tissue in that area is very important for transporting nutrients up and down the tree and transporting water up the tree. And so as the larva feed, they damage some of those vessels that transport the fluids, and that eventually girdles the tree and causes the death of the tree.
There are signs that an ash tree has been infested with the emerald ash borer. Experts point to a thinning crown of the tree, long shoots growing from the trunk or branches, small D-shaped holes in the bark where the beetles emerge from, and S-shaped holes under the bark that are filled with a fine sawdust. All of these are signs that the emerald ash borer is impacting the tree. Spalding says the emerald ash borer has decimated tree populations east of the Rocky Mountains, and arborists don't yet know how the native Oregon ash will fare against this threat.
We are going to find out how susceptible the native Oregon ash is. Those are planted all over. A lot of the green ash trees are typically planted as street trees and in planters and in like parking lots. You find those quite a lot on the street. So I lived in Chicago for 3 years during the hard thick of the ash pandemic when this was going on as a consulting arborist. And it was really hard to convey the importance of treating the trees prior to them being infested. And after it's got about a 20% canopy dieback, it's not worth treating anymore and should be removed. There was a lot of money spent with municipalities. There was a lot of heartache with prized trees in people's properties that had to be removed. It decimates every ash tree in the area.
The emerald ash borer is native to northeastern Asia, and ash trees there co-evolved with the beetle to have stronger defenses. Scientists believe the beetle was brought to North America around 2002 in wood packaging from Asia. Climate change has also made these emerald ash borer infestations worse, Spalding explains.
Climate change stresses out the trees with our longer, hotter, drier summers. And with a stressed tree, you have a weakened immune system, just like a human being. It's more difficult for the tree to fight off the pests, and you also see multiple seasons of these pests. So instead of having one generational cycle, you'll have three or four generational cycles because of a longer, hotter, drier, livable season for them.
People can act now to protect local ash trees from the emerald ash borer beetle, Spalding says, but it's important not to wait until the beetle has already started in on the tree.
Well, the most important thing you can do is keep the health of the tree boosted. So you need to be doing deep root treatments and bringing nutrients to the tree, as well as you have to be treating the tree with an insecticide, an internal insecticide that's targeted for the emerald ash borer. It's a probe about 8 inches long, and you step it down, and it's a high pressure injection that goes in deep into the soil, all around the root flares, the soil profile, all beneath the canopy of the tree. And if they're not treated, it's almost a guarantee that if the tree's not treated, it will be taken out. You would definitely want to consult an arborist. Every arborist that comes out should be a free consultation, and they should be able to educate you. My goal is to educate you first. This is something that you could do as a homeowner, but it's going to require a little bit of equipment. So you can either pay for the services, or you can educate yourself and do them yourself.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
Republican state legislatures in Montana are making a power grab. They want to do away with a requirement that interim committees have the same number of representatives from both parties. It would give the GOP more power between elections in that state. But both sides of the aisle support leaving the Committee on State-Tribal Relations unchanged. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's days of partisan balance and interim committees could soon come to an end. While the GOP wants more power between legislative sessions, there was wide support to leave one committee unchanged. That's the liaison between the state and tribal nations. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin has more.
Senate Bill 176, which has already passed through the Senate, would restructure interim committees to have more members from the majority party. It passed an initial House vote closely along party lines Tuesday. Representative Amy Regeer from Kalispell says this change better reflects the makeup of the legislature and the GOP's supermajority.
A 50-50 makeup of interim committees does not reflect the will of the voters. Senate Bill 176 would correct that.
Before the House voted in support of the policy, it amended it with a carve-out to keep equal bipartisan balance on the State-Tribal Relations Interim Committee. Representative Tyson Running Wolf, a Democrat from Browning, said that since the majority of the state's American Indian Caucus members are Democrats, changing that committee's structure would negatively affect tribal representation.
Fewer tribal members on state tribal would decrease the understanding of these unique differences, and it can sometimes bring policy that is not in the best interest of the tribes.
Six tribal lawmakers sat on this 10-person committee last interim to study issues like missing and murdered Indigenous persons and tribal economic development. The amendment passed with strong bipartisan support in the House on Tuesday. Having passed its final vote in the House, the bill will be returned to the Senate for approval on the amendment. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
A lawsuit is taking the state of Alaska to task for failed salmon runs in western Alaska. It claims the state has not only mismanaged the fisheries, but also violated the state constitution. As reported in the Alaska Beacon, the case was heard this week in a courtroom in Bethel, one of many communities hit hard by the salmon crisis on the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers, where runs have been so weak, traditional native subsistence harvests have been restricted or banned. The state's management of the salmon runs has pitted different regions of the state and different Alaska Native groups against each other. The attorney arguing says that the state has failed to follow the Constitution's principle of sustained yield, which requires a balance between harvesting fish and managing their numbers. The case is one of the first to challenge the state in court over salmon disasters. Western Alaska fishermen have pushed state managers to restrict fishing on the Alaska Peninsula to protect salmon that are being caught incidentally as fishermen target other species of fish. The state asked the judge to dismiss the lawsuit. It argued that it should be thrown out because it doesn't challenge any specific management decisions. It cited poor salmon runs is not enough to build a case against the state. The judge could take 6 months to decide if the case will go forward. Fans crowded into the Alaska Airlines Center in Anchorage this week to cheer on their favorite teams during state basketball championship games. This year, a unique partnership is bringing together basketball and Native art. Artists are set up on the third floor of the center for the inaugural Alaska Native Art Market. Fanny Perry is a Yupik artist whose table was full of crocheted hats and seal and otter fur slippers. Perry says it's important for Alaska Native artists to be successful selling their work because for many, it's their livelihood. For Perry, returning to the arena is like coming back to her old stomping grounds.
I'm a huge basketball fan. I love basketball. And so 20 plus years ago, my team was actually down the court. I love events like this. I love seeing other people coming together and just enjoying themselves.
The Alaska School Activities Association teamed up with the Alaska Native Heritage Center for the art market. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report from AARP finds that family caregivers in Washington state provide nearly $17 billion in unpaid work each year. Advocates say it underscores the importance of these contributions to the state. Eric Tagedhoff has the details.
Family caregivers provide valuable work to Washington state, even if they don't get paid. A new report puts a value to the unpaid work they do. In 2021, the state had 820,000 family caregivers, according to a new AARP analysis. They provided an estimated $16.8 billion in economic value that year. Kathy McCall with AARP Washington says this report quantifies how important family caregivers are to the state.
It really calls out and sings the praises of an unrecognized workforce that is so pivotal to our overall long-term care system.
The report finds the value of that care provided to family members increased by $4.8 billion between 2019 and 2021 in Washington state. Dana Allard-Webb is manager of Washington's Family Caregiver Support Program. It offers services to help caregivers with their duties and to cope with the stress of the job, such as through respite care. She says it's hard for many to ask for help, but support from the program can be good for everyone involved.
The calmer, more mentally and physically healthy a caregiver is, and the more educated they are, the better they're going to be able to care for that care receiver, and they'll be able to hopefully care for them longer.
According to the report, people age 65 and up will outnumber those under age 18 by 2034. McCall says it's important for policymakers to recognize the state's population is aging rapidly.
There's really no way that Washington state or the federal government would be able to compensate people or provide this level of care that unpaid family caregivers currently provide.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tagedhoff.
Reports from the World Health Organization and the American College of Cardiology find that the world is eating too much salt and that low-carb, high-fat diets aren't as healthy as they're made out to be. Sorry, keto fans, but there are ways to get people on track and eating right to remain healthy. Edwin J. Vieira reports.
Two recent reports take aim at improving health across the world and the U.S. A report from the World Health Organization finds the world is off track to meet a global goal of reducing sodium intake. Every member state of the WHO pledged to reduce sodium intake by 30% by 2025, but only 9 countries have adopted policies that will achieve that goal. The WHO's sodium scorecard shows the U.S. has policies in place to reduce sodium, albeit not to the organization's recommended levels. Dr. Julie Chen with Kaiser Permanente notes people can check food packaging at the grocery store and describes low-sodium meal preparation options.
things like garlic, lemon, many of the ingredients that are aromatic but do not contain sodium are good ways to flavor foods but decrease the salt content of the meal.
Chen adds canned and prepackaged foods might have more sodium than people realize. According to the USDA's 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines, Americans should consume less than 2,300 milligrams of sodium per day as part of a healthy eating pattern. But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds, on average, Americans consume at least 3,400 milligrams of sodium per day. I'm Edwin J. Vieira. Research from the American College of Cardiology finds low-carb, high-fat diets like keto are actually not as healthy as they might appear. Researchers find there's a causal relationship going on these kinds of diets and having high levels of pain and heart attack.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 24th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, Catherine Carley, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give, or you can do the text thing and go to KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin. Have a great night.